Today I wanted to talk to you about limitations of point-of-care testing and go through some of the important initial tests that you can run in the initial time period after an emergency patient is presented to you. I also want to focus a little bit on monitoring as well, because even though it's not a specific test, I think that monitoring can be included in that initial 5 to 10 minutes of information gathering for us to sort out what exactly is going on with that patient. So today I want to go over the purpose and limitations of point-of-care testing, to understand which monitors are useful for quick information gathering and what that information means, and to understand the limitations of a few select monitoring equipment pieces that we use. So the purpose of point-of-care testing, this is not to replace the CBC, chemistry, urinalysis, things that you send off. It's for you to be able to sort out life-threatening problems. It's information you get within 5 to 10 minutes of the animals getting there. It can be cage-side patient information that'll complement the findings from the initial triage and physical exam that you have. When do you do this? You do it in initial presentation, but you also need to do point-of-care testing when you have very dynamic patients, patients that are changing rapidly, and is very important in monitoring of critical care patients. And I really want to focus on the fact that when we get this information, what we're really trying to do is rule out anything life-threatening. It's not to make a full diagnosis of what's going on, but it is to help us try and treat those life-threatening problems so that that animal can survive to the point that we can further the diagnosis for the owners. But there are limitations, and you need to be familiar with your machines. You need to do quality control on your machines. And I'm not going to go specifically through every type of machine, because there's so many ones out there. But it's extremely important, because if you don't do quality control on them, then you can get spurious results, and things that look life-threatening may not be, or vice versa. This is not an all-inclusive list, but I think it's probably the most important diseases or processes that I feel we need to rule out when an emergency patient arrives. Obviously, a patient in shock or sepsis, in respiratory distress, or that has cardiac disease are some of the biggest ones that we need to rule out. And these point-of-care tests are going to be useful in helping to rule these in or out, again, in conjunction with our physical exam findings. But there's numerous other disorders, and I personally think that we can rule out all of these things or rule them in if we are able to do what I call the extended database on most of our patients. And that's what I'm going to focus on during this lecture, is what the extended database is and what information it can tell us. And if you then reflect back on this list, you'll probably see we can rule in or out almost every single one of these problems for these animals. So the extended database really consists of a multitude of tests, and it's also focused on the fact that in emergency practice, I feel it's really important to be able to do electrolytes as well as acid-base status. I think a lot of people have been doing PCB total protein, glucose, and BUN for a long time, but the addition of electrolytes, lactate, a venous blood gas or an arterial blood gas, in addition to getting a urine-specific gravity, and then doing your own blood smear, and then potentially adding on looking at COAG status, ECG, blood pressure, and pulse oximetry. So I'm going to run through all of these and start with the PCV. And I know this sounds really basic, but sometimes I think it's really important to reflect upon some of the things that we do on an everyday basis and what we can actually gather from that information. As you know, the PCV is the percentage of whole blood that contains red blood cells compared to plasma. It's centrifuged in hematocrit tubes and then measured on a chart such as this one. And one of the things I want to point out is that doing a PCV allows you to also look at plasma color. This is really important to train your technicians, if they're the ones that are running the test, to look at to tell you whether it's lipemic or icteric or hemolysized, because then we can gather that information and use it to help us interpret the PCV as well as the total protein. If the PCV is low, we go back to the basics of anemia, which could be loss, destruction, decreased production, or sequestration. But I want to stress that a lot of patients come in hemorrhaging, and the total protein will drop before the PCV during acute hemorrhage due to splenic contraction, and this is true in the dog and the cat. So a lot of times they'll come in with a normal PCV, but a total protein of around 4, and I don't want you to be fooled into thinking that that animal is not going to become anemic, because they frequently will if they're in the acute hemorrhagic state. Again, plasma color and total protein can help differentiate the causes of anemia. If it's hemolyzed or icteric, we may go more down the route of an immune-mediated anemia, versus if the plasma looks clear, it may be more associated with hemorrhage. You also want to look at how the patient's handling the anemia. If it's chronic, the patient's probably going to look fairly bright and alert, despite a very low PCV, versus a animal that is acutely hemorrhaging. They're not going to tolerate the blood loss or the anemia well at all, and they'll be in shock and very tachycardic, and they'll have a high respiratory rate. The flip side of this is that we may see polycythemic animals, so very high PCV, and the most common cause in emergency medicine is hemoconcentration, but chronic hypoxia as well as primary polycythemic disorders cannot be ruled out, and this is where our total protein comes into play, because using it in conjunction with the PCV is very useful, and I'll go through a few examples. There are some limitations of the PCV. Diluted samples are very common, especially if the sample was drawn from a catheter. I think we've all seen that. The centrifuge speed and length of time can alter results, so it's very important to make sure that your centrifuge is maintained properly and serviced regularly. There's obviously minor subjective errors in reading. And if you've recently given the animal a lot of fluids, it takes about a half hour for crystalloids to redistribute throughout the body. So if you give a bolus of fluids and you immediately take a PCV, that PCV is going to be artificially low, and it's probably better to wait about 30 to 60 minutes to get a more accurate view of what that PCV really dropped to with the amount of crystalloids that you gave. If there's a blood clot in the tube, it can alter the results. It can either raise or lower the PCV. So it's very important to keep all of those things in mind when interpreting the PCV. And to interpret it, again, in conjunction with the total protein. Now, most of us measure the total protein on a refractometer. And it's really important to realize, and this is why it's good to train your technicians to look at the plasma, is that the total protein can be significantly elevated with lipemia. This particular dog, again, had a very lipemic sample. You can see how white the plasma is there, and the total protein of this dog was 11. When we sent it into the lab and it was air-fuged and the lipemia was gotten rid of, the animal actually had a normal total protein. So that's really important to keep in mind. If the total protein is low, we go back again to the basic causes of hypoproteinemia. Loss could be GI losses, hemorrhage, or renal causes, or it could be decreased production such as liver failure. If you have a high total protein, dehydration or hyperglobulinemia should come to mind. The problem with doing just a total protein, though, is that you can't differentiate between panhypoproteinemia versus just hypoalbuminemia. So I still think it's really important to look for albumin and globulins in this case, but it's sometimes confusing if you just look at the total protein, because you can't differentiate them. And the same is true if you have a high total protein. You can't differentiate between just a global panhyperproteinemia versus just a hyperglobulinemia that's causing that hyperproteinemia. And again, lipemia can artificially raise the total protein, but there is evidence that icterus and hemolysis also can artificially raise the total protein. Another reason to look at that plasma. So if you have an animal come in with a fairly normal PCV and total protein, then I don't think that there's anything to be concerned about, obviously. But if I see both the PCV and total protein elevated, such as in this example, where it's 55 PCV and 8.5 total protein, the most common cause of that is dehydration. That's pretty basic. I think we all know that. The PCV is 40 and the total protein is low at 4, I would be very suspicious that this is an acute hemorrhage case and that we're going to see anemia after our volume resuscitation. The other possibility is that the animal has a primary protein loss somewhere, such as protein-losing enteropathy or protein-losing nephropathy, and you have to look at your patient to be able to sort that out. If I saw both the total protein and PCV being low, I would suspect that it would be late hemorrhage or potentially hemorrhage after aggressive volume resuscitation. This is the classic example that we see in the emergency room of a high PCV with a relatively low total protein, and as you volume resuscitate this animal, that total protein is going to drop even more. And this might be a case that I would consider going to use colloid therapy if I had to get really aggressive about volume resuscitation, because I would be worried that our colloid pressure would drop significantly since we're already starting at a relatively low total protein and we know it's going to drop more with fluid therapy. This is a classic example of hemorrhagic gastroenteritis. And then we have the situation where we have a low PCV and a normal total protein, and I would generally think that this means that there's red blood cell destruction or lack of production going on, such as a feline leukemia cat or a bone marrow disease animal or some sort of immune-mediated problem going on. You want to look at the plasma color very closely in these cases to help differentiate, as well as your patient. And again, the chronicity of the anemia is going to give you clues. And then if I had a very high PCV with a normal total protein, this is a little bit different than the hemorrhagic gastroenteritis case where the total protein was actually a little bit low. This total protein is normal. And it still could have a dehydration component to it, but I would really be going down the route of a primary polycythemia disorder. And then lastly, if I had a PCV that was 45%, which is normal, or with a high total protein, I would think that this animal is hyperglobulinemic. And the reason why I say that is because the albumin really can't go much higher than 4 or 4.5. And so if we're starting to get up in the 11 and 12s of the total protein, we're probably dealing with a globulin problem. And that's really important because in hyperglobulinemic cases, it should clue you into the fact that the animal has some sort of chronic antigenic stimulation going on, so either some sort of neoplasia or chronic infectious disease that may be contributing to the animal's illness. I've had several animals come in with just hyperglobulinemia and general illness, and we've diagnosed Ehrlichia, for instance. So I think it's really important to recognize. And again, just make sure that the animal's not lipemic and that this isn't an artificially elevated total protein. So that's pretty basic, but I just think it's so amazing what we can get from that simple test within 5 to 10 minutes and how much information and things we can rule in and rule out with a PCV total protein. The same thing is true of a glucose. Glucose generally is measured on a glucometer or some sort of blood gas machine. I would like to mention that glucometers in general are designed for human diabetics, and because of that, there is an error that is purposely put into glucometers where they read approximately 20 milligrams per deciliter lower than they are when an animal or a person is hypoglycemic, because they don't want a diabetic to go around with a really low glucose. So even though their glucose might be 70, it's going to read 50, which is going to prompt the person to go drink orange juice or something so they don't go into a hypoglycemic crisis. Now, this is kind of a rough estimate, but I believe a lot of the tests have shown that glucometers are actually very accurate at high glucoses. But when we're dealing with hypoglycemic animals, my suggestion to you is if it's really, really low, and the patient doesn't look like they're hypoglycemic, then I would retest it with either a different machine or with the same one, and just verify whether it's real or not. So you want to look at your patient, again, if it comes up hypoglycemic. Are they showing clinical signs? Seizuring doesn't typically occur in hypoglycemic animals unless the glucose is below 40 milligrams per deciliter. You also want to determine, is your patient pediatric versus an adult? Pediatric patients are obviously going to be much more prone to hypoglycemia than an adult patient. And what is the size and species of the animal that you're dealing with? If this was a ferret, I certainly would believe it a lot more than if it was, a young Labrador. The patient size is very important, but the species is as well, because ferrets are extremely prone to insulinoma, and it's one of the most common emergency presentations of ferrets. The other question is, and why it might be important to make sure that you're not dealing with a truly hypoglycemic animal when they're normoglycemic, is because there has been some evidence to show that just any glucose supplementation for no reason whatsoever is not necessarily good for the patient. If the patient is septic or in the systemic inflammatory response syndrome, it's been shown that glucose supplementation actually can increase lactate production and contribute to lactic acidosis. So I don't like to just spike the bag with dextrose unless there's a reason to. I mean, if they're hypoglycemic, they absolutely need it. But if they're normoglycemic or on the edge and you're able to continue to monitor glucose, then I'm not a person who likes to just arbitrarily supplement glucose, because it's had some negative outcomes in some of the studies in human medicine. Obviously, if they're hypoglycemic, you want to make sure it's not lab errors I've talked about. And then some rule-outs that should come to mind are listed here: sepsis, insulinoma, starvation, and if they're a pediatric patient. And then if they're hyperglycemic, we know that cats can get a stress hyperglycemia, but diabetes mellitus, massive epinephrine release, as well as head trauma, all are causes of significant hyperglycemia. I also think it's really important to get a look at the ability of the kidneys to be working. And BUN and creatinine are the mainstay of our renal values in veterinary medicine. The problem with BUN is that it's less specific to the kidney, and it may be elevated with GI hemorrhage. And the creatinine, if you have the ability to measure, is going to be a lot more renal specific than BUN. If these are elevated, the main categories should be pre-renal, renal, or post-renal. And it's best to do this in conjunction with a urine-specific gravity, which I'll get to in just 1 second. You can do a BUN on a blood gas machine. A lot of them currently have the ability to measure BUN. Some of them have the ability to measure creatinine. We have the AZA stick that a lot of us are familiar with. And I think that the AZA stick is very useful. You just put a drop of whole blood on it, and it ranges from light green to dark green. And I don't think that they're real, real accurate, but if you get an animal that has a really dark green strip, which means that the BUN is greater than 80, I think that you can believe that that animal is truly azotemic. And that may help you when an owner is trying to decide whether to continue on with care or not. Using the BUN in conjunction with the urine-specific gravity is very important. I will like to say that the specific gravity is probably the most important thing to get pre-fluids. You can get your dipstick or your sediment or the rest of your analysis at any other time. But once you give that animal fluids, the specific gravity is going to be altered. And you're not going to know if they're azotemic and they're isosthenuric. You're not going to know if the isosthenuria was there before the fluids or if they were able to concentrate their urine before the fluids. So a pre-fluid specific gravity is most useful. I want to just say, though, that I don't think it's right to withhold fluid therapy just to get a specific gravity. Sometimes we just have to deal with the fact that we can't get urine. But don't be afraid to get, if they pee on the table or on the floor, or even on a towel, you can squeeze some of that out because you don't need it for the dipstick and just get a specific gravity. You just need a drop. You also should make sure that they don't have any coagulation abnormalities prior to getting a cystocentesis, and I'll talk a little bit about looking for coagulation disorders a little bit later. Again, don't withhold fluids just to get a specific gravity, but it can confuse the picture if we don't have that. If you're using the urine to look for ketones, and you have an animal that you suspect is a diabetic ketoacidosis, and you cannot get urine on the animal, which is very true of some of these very dehydrated cats that come in, you can use the plasma from your PCV total protein tube and on the urine dipstick, and right on the ketone part of it, and it is just as accurate as the urine is to look for ketones. We have had some situations where the ketones are positive in the plasma and negative in the urine, and so it seems like the plasma may be a little bit more sensitive in picking up the ketones. But it's definitely a good way to look and diagnose a DKA versus just a plain old diabetic. And then on these urine dipsticks, you know, there's lots of things we can look at here, but the leukocyte and nitrates on them are not accurate. They're made for humans, and they're not validated in the dog or the cat. So when we look at some examples of azotemia with urine-specific gravity, if I had an animal with an elevated BUN and creatinine and a concentrated urine-specific gravity, I would think this is a prerenal azotemia and that the animal is dehydrated. If I had the same situation with the urine-specific gravity as isosinuric, I would think that this was a renal azotemia, but almost every type of renal azotemia has a prerenal component. We just can't determine what that prerenal component is because they aren't concentrating their urine. If I had a disparity between BUN and creatinine where the BUN was much higher than the creatinine and the creatinine was actually normal, with a middle-of-the-road urine-specific gravity, I would think that this animal might have some GI hemorrhaging, and I would kind of go down the route of that with this profile, and that's one reason why it's actually nice to get both BUN and creatinine if you can. Those of you who were in my lecture yesterday, I mentioned that there are some new urine drug tests that can be done as well. This is the MedImpex Multidrug 9 test. It's an illicit drug test for 9 different illicit drugs, looking at cocaine, amphetamine, methamphetamine, marijuana, methadone, opioids, PCP, barbiturates, and benzodiazepines. We have diagnosed a lot of these animals with urine dipsticks, and it's very useful because it allows us to know how to treat them properly. This particular animal came in and was positive for opioids and benzodiazepines, and the reason for that was because the veterinarian had sedated it with hydromorphone and Valium before sending it in, and it was not positive for anything else. These are about $20 to the client, and they're really very useful, but I will say that the marijuana portion of this has not been accurate in dogs. We've had some known marijuana dogs that have not been positive on the urine drug test. And this has been on VIN as well, and so it doesn't seem like it's just occurring here at CSU. The electrolytes that I think are really important to look at are sodium, potassium, chloride, and ionized calcium. I think that we can glean a lot of information from this and look at life-threatening problems, especially potassiums. This particular animal came in with a potassium greater than 9, as well as a hypocalcemia. In fact, this animal was extremely acidotic as well, had a pH of 6.9. And just from this blood gas, I figured out that the animal had gotten into ethylene glycol. I would like to say that ionized calcium reads artificially low if the sample's over heparinized, so you need to get a very good sample in order to get an accurate ionized calcium. In fact, ionized calcium is one of the most common lab error values that we get. And if the animal is significantly acidotic, it actually increases the ionized calcium because there's less calcium bound to the protein. So you have more free calcium floating around. So this case, as I mentioned, the pH of this animal was 6.9 and the ionized calcium was 0.83, which is higher than it normally would be anyway. If I corrected this animal's acidosis, my ionized calcium is going to just bottom out. It's probably going to be down around 0.4, which most animals start seizuring if it's down. Some start around 0.8, but most of the ones I see are around 0.6, at least on the iStat. So you really need to keep that in mind too when you're dealing with ionized calcium. So you also need to make sure that when you get a sample and you're looking at electrolytes and you're getting the sample from the catheter, that they're not contaminated with fluids or additives, especially if you've given potassium chloride additives. We had a dog that was on total parenteral nutrition, and the nurse didn't stop the fluids before the draw, and we got very misleading numbers. So it's really important to make sure you stop the fluids before drawing out of the catheter. And then the hematocrit and hemoglobin on these blood gas machines usually is not accurate, so I wouldn't trust them necessarily. Lactate, I think a lot of us in emergency practice are using this now. It's a great measure of perfusion. It's a predictor of gastric necrosis and GDV if the lactate is greater than 6 millimoles per liter. How quickly the lactate drops may be more important than the initial absolute lactate. There's been some evidence in human medicine that, you know, even if you have an initial very high lactate, if you can get that lactate down very quickly, so like rechecking it within an hour or two, and it goes down to near normal, then the prognosis for that animal is actually a lot better. We haven't studied this in veterinary medicine, but I suspect it's probably true in veterinary medicine. So it's, in general, a very great tool to assess response to resuscitation, and these little lactate machines are very accurate and fairly inexpensive if you don't have them in your practice already. And this is the rest of that blood gas from that kitty, the 6.927 blood gas. But it's very important to look at acid-base status in our patients and learn to interpret not only arterial blood gases, but venous blood gases, and to understand what the difference is between the venous and the arterial blood gas. Venous blood gases can be used for looking at acid-base status as well as ventilatory status, because the CO2 on the venous side is always going to be higher than the arterial side. So if you have an animal that has a normal CO2 on the venous side, you know that they are ventilating normally on the arterial side. So it's very useful to look at ventilatory status on a venous blood gas and not have to worry about getting an arterial blood gas. And again, it's accurate at looking at acid-base status. In fact, during CPR, venous blood gases give a more accurate picture of the global acid-base status than arterial blood gases do, because it's actually looking at what's happening at the tissue level rather than the fact that you probably have a pretty good acid-base status on the arterial side during CPR because it's not getting any gas exchange. So all you're getting is what's coming from the lungs directly to the artery. A pH of less than 7.2 leads to cellular dysfunction, and if you have a pH less than 7.0, it's generally life-threatening, and the patient's frequently moribund, and it really is very useful in that emergency situation when you're trying to help that owner decide whether to go on or not, because I've had very few cases where the pH is less than 7 that I've been able to ultimately pull the patient through. I can pull them through probably for the first 24 hours, but for some reason they seem to still not make it a lot of the times. I wouldn't, you know, there's nothing out there that says, you know, pH less than 7, you should euthanize. That's not what I'm trying to say, but I really think that it helps you help the owner make the decision as far as how far to go with their pet. As far as looking at oxygenation, arterial blood gases are the only thing you can look at in truly determining how well that animal is oxygenating. The venous blood gas will not help you with that. But you can look at venous oxygen tensions if you are in a place that you want to look at oxygen extraction and you want to compare arterial oxygen to venous oxygen. Anybody who's interested in doing that, I'd be happy to chat with them or email them on how to do that. And then the only other thing that I use venous oxygen for is that a venous oxygen less than 20 millimeters of mercury has been associated with poor prognosis in people. So if I see a venous blood gas less than 20, as far as the arterial venous oxygen tension goes, I start to get a little bit concerned, and I use it to help make a prognosis as well. I think it's imperative that we look at a blood smear, even if you happen to have a CBC machine in your hospital, because a lot of the CBC machines aren't all that accurate. They can misinterpret cells, especially platelets tend to be a little bit inaccurate. And if there happens to be any circulating lymphoblasts or anything like that, the machines can't really pick up on that sometimes. So I think it's really important to verify your CBC results with a blood smear. And just get in the habit of having your technicians do a blood smear when they're drawing their PCV and total protein and all the other point-of-care tests that you're doing. This will allow you to just do a white blood cell estimate, 5 to 15 white blood cells per 10 power field, really useful when trying to diagnose parvo or feline panleukopenia. Looking at red blood cell morphology, very important, again, if you suspect an animal has IMHA. If it's a dog, you can look for spherocytes, anisocytosis, polychromasia. The platelet estimate, again, 8 to 12 platelets per 100 power field, very important to look at, but to make sure that there aren't platelet clumps in the feathered edge that might make it look like the animal's thrombocytopenic, even though that they really aren't. It also, this blood smear then leads us into the looking at the coagulation status of the animal. It's really important to look at primary hemostasis and secondary hemostasis. So primary hemostasis is that initial platelet plug that occurs when an animal is bleeding. The secondary hemostasis is when the coagulation pathways get stimulated and that clot stabilizes. So the platelet count is a very important part of that because thrombocytopenic animals can't clot blood well because they have defective primary hemostasis. There also can be defects in platelet function, even though their platelet count is normal, such as with von Willebrand's disease. And the only way that you can test for this without sending off a von Willebrand's titer would be to do a buccal mucosal bleeding time, which is a very simple thing to do, even in the emergency clinic, but you have to make sure that the platelet count is normal before you do that. Most of the books say they can be mildly thrombocytopenic, and the buccal mucosal bleeding time is still pretty accurate. I like to see the platelet count at least over 120,000 before I trust the buccal mucosal bleeding time. Primary hemostasis typically causes mucosal bleeding, epistaxis, and petechia, and doesn't tend to cause cavity bleeding, such as hemothorax or hemoabdomen. Then we want to look at the secondary pathway, especially if we have a bleeding animal here, and determine if they have a problem with their secondary clotting cascade. One thing you can do is an activated clotting time. This looks at the intrinsic pathway of the clotting cascade, and normal is less than 120 seconds. I think some of us are probably pretty familiar with this. It's just a heat block with a tube that has diatomaceous earth in it. You put about 2 mL in it and warm it up for 60 seconds, and then every 5 seconds after that, you look at the tube to see if a clot is forming. So it's fairly subjective, but it's still a really good test to do. There are also automated ACT machines that you can get now that you just put them in, and they spin them for you, and it will give you the activated clotting time. The main difference between looking at ACT versus the PT or PTT is that the activated clotting time can be affected by low platelets, and it can be user-dependent if you're not using the automated machine. Secondary hemostasis is a little bit more accurate to look at prothrombin time and activated partial thromboplastin time. This again looks at the same pathway that the ACT does, except for it doesn't take into consideration the platelets. The PTT looks at the same pathway as the ACT. The PT looks at the extrinsic pathway, and the reason why this is important to differentiate is because the extrinsic pathway takes into consideration factor 7, which is the first factor that is depleted in rodenticide, anticoagulant rodenticide toxicosis. Really important to be able to differentiate the PT and the PTT. And the STA-2000 has been validated in both the dog and the cat and is a very, very nice point-of-care coagulation machine that I think has really changed the way veterinarians are able to treat coagulopathies in private practice. So we used to get a lot of referrals just for coagulopathy. I need a coag on this animal. I have no way to do it without sending it out, and it's really important to get it today. And now I get a lot less of those because of this machine. So if I saw an animal come in, this is where your physical exam really helps, with bilateral epistaxis, melena, hyphema, and petechia, that you can see on the gums of this dog, on the mucous membranes, I would think that this is a primary disorder. I would still want to run the PT and PTT, and if they happen to be normal, I would want to also look at the platelet count, because we said that a lot of mucosal bleeding is due to primary platelet disorders, and this particular dog happened to have thrombocytopenia on a blood smear. And so then we go through our rule outs of destruction, use, and non-production, and are able to guide the owner as to what to do next. If I saw an animal come in that was dyspneic, had dull lung sounds ventrally, pale mucous membranes, hemothorax on thoracocentesis, and had evidence of both anemia and hypoproteinemia, I would think that the animal was hemorrhaging somewhere, and it was probably late hemorrhage. And if I was able to measure the coag and the prothrombin time was the only thing that was elevated, then I would think that the animal had rodenticide toxicity. And so this makes it a very straightforward diagnosis in private practice now. These are from Robin Van Meter, who's in the audience. She sent me these pictures of a lepto dog that was icteric in the sclera and on the gums. They're great pictures. If this animal came in vomiting with icterus and a bruised abdomen ventrally, and I ran a PT and PTT and they were both elevated, then I would think that the animal, the rule outs I would go through in my mind is that maybe the animal's in DIC. Typically they have low platelets in addition to an elevated PT and PTT if they are in DIC, as well as increased fibrodegradation products and D-dimers. And there are some point-of-care D-dimer tests out there now, too, which I think some emergency practices are using. I also would be concerned that the animal is in liver failure because the coag factors are made by the liver. As far as other tests go, other than the actual test that we run, an ECG is very important, just to look to see if the animal's tachycardic or bradycardic. If they're tachycardic, I would wonder if they're in shock, have pain, or primary cardiac arrhythmias. If they're bradycardic, they might have electrolyte abnormalities like potassium elevation or primary cardiac arrhythmias. I'm also looking for other types of arrhythmias that you may have heard on auscultation, such as VPCs or atrial fibrillation, and then potentially electrical alternans, which may lead us to pericardial effusion. The ECG can have some limitations. Poor contact, shivering, and patient movement can lead to background noise, making the ECG difficult to interpret. And electrical activity continue long after the heart has stopped, beating due to pulseless electrical activity and electromechanical dissociation. The longest I ever saw was in a horse that I euthanized that had a normal ECG 15 minutes after we euthanized it on the table. And so I don't think we see it quite to that extent in small animals, but I've seen it definitely an animal have a normal ECG for about 3 or 4 minutes after it's dead. And that's really important to know, because if you're anesthetizing or sedating animals, you really need to have an audible pulse and not just an ECG for your monitoring. So ECG is no substitute for an audible pulse or heartbeat. And then alcohol as a contact agent can cause fire. And so if the patient needs to be defibrillated, it really is best to use gel as your contact agent. We've seen this a few times. I've been told of stories of patients catching on fire after defibrillation because of alcohol as the contact agent. So at least at the University of Pennsylvania, we never had alcohol in the room so that we didn't accidentally put them on the leads. But we use alcohol routinely at CSU on the leads, and I haven't seen a problem yet. Indirect blood pressure, just remember blood pressure is cardiac output times systemic vascular resistance. It's one of the best objective measurements of perfusion we have, but it may be difficult to measure during hypotension or poor perfusion. My target in awake animals is a mean arterial pressure greater than 80, and you can use either a Doppler or an oscillometric blood pressure monitor. The Doppler only gives systolic pressures, and under anesthesia, a lot of the research has shown that it's actually equates closer to mean pressure than systolic pressure in cats. It does allow for an audible pulse throughout the entire procedure, but it may not work well if the animal is severely vasoconstricted. In oscillometric blood pressure, it gives systolic, diastolic, and mean pressure, and it must match the heart rate to be considered accurate. The cuff size is very important, and the Cardell is the only oscillometric blood pressure monitor that has been shown to be accurate in cats. The Dynamap and other blood pressure monitors are not accurate in cats. And again, it won't read well with poor perfusion and hypotension. And then pulse oximetry is kind of hit or miss. There's some newer pulse oximeters out there that I've tried, which work really well in dogs. The Masimo is the one I'm talking about, but it doesn't seem to work well in cats. It's an indirect method of measuring hemoglobin saturation. It emits two wavelengths of light to determine oxyhemoglobin and deoxyhemoglobin, and accounts for tissue absorption by assuming only arterial blood pulses. But ambient light, low perfusion, motion will all affect the pulse oximeter. So you need to look for a matching heart rate, and if you happen to have like a little pulse waveform or something on there, you want to look for a strong signal for you to believe the pulse oximeter. If there's artifacts present, the reading will frequently default to about 85%, and carboxyhemoglobin and methemoglobin will both interfere with the pulse oximeter. And another limitation of the pulse oximeter is that it only will tell you the saturation up to 97%, whereas the animal's arterial oxygen tension can be anywhere from 100 to 500 if they're on supplemental oxygen. So it may give you an artificial sense of security in certain patients because of that disparity between the arterial oxygen tension and the oxygen saturation. There are lots of other respiratory monitors that we can use, capnography, respirometry, apnea monitors, tidal flow volume loops, and transcutaneous oxygen monitoring. I just briefly wanted to mention capnography. This is not in your proceedings, but capnography is very useful because it's a good representation of the arterial CO2. The unfortunate thing is that you have to have the animal intubated to use it. The end-tidal CO2 is usually 4 to 6 millimeters of mercury lower than the arterial CO2. And this gradient is due to mixing of gas from the alveoli that are being perfused with alveoli that are not being perfused. The reason why I like end-tidal CO2 is in the emergency setting is during cardiac arrest. the end-tidal CO2 is frequently less than 10 millimeters of mercury due to little to no pulmonary capillary perfusion. So if you have your end-tidal CO2 hooked up during CPR and you can get an end-tidal CO2 over 10, you are doing great compressions. I can tell you that. You should target a 10 to 15 millimeter CO2. And if there's return to spontaneous circulation, that end-tidal CO2 is going to skyrocket and go up into the 30s and 40s. It's also a great tool in under anesthesia because it's the first thing that you're going to see if an animal is going into cardiac arrest. You're going to see a drop in that end-tidal CO2. It's going to help with the adequacy of chest compressions and help you know if there's a return to spontaneous circulation. Some other additional monitoring you might do in your practice is direct arterial blood pressure and central venous pressure monitoring. Central venous pressure, you need a central line in the right atrium. Normal is less than 5 centimeters of water. It determines the preload to the heart. A high CVP may indicate volume overload or low cardiac output, and a low CVP is hypovolemia. It's very useful to evaluate response to and capacity for fluid loading and aids in determining success of like a pericardiocentesis for cardiac tamponade. Whereas direct arterial blood pressure monitoring, the main limitation is that you have to get an arterial line in. But it's great for serial arterial blood gas sampling, continuous real-time monitoring. If you need to manipulate the cardiovascular system with drugs, or your indirect blood pressure monitoring is not working. Sorry, that got a little bit out of order. CVP monitoring, going back to that, can be artificially high if the patient is in dorsal recumbency. And it's important to realize that the water manometers read in centimeters of water and the transducers read in millimeters of mercury. And 1 millimeter of mercury equals 1.36 centimeters of water, so you have to make that conversion. Animals should be in lateral recumbency to get an accurate CVP, and kink catheters can lead to artificially high CVPs. And lastly, I just wanted to mention abdominal monitoring, cytology, and colloid osmotic pressure. It's really important to look at if you have fluid in the abdomen, you need to do cytology on it. The problem is if you do an abdominocentesis, they generally need to have 20 to 30 mils per kilo of fluid in the abdomen to have a positive blind tap. An ultrasound machine is very useful in these situations if they don't have a lot of fluid in there. And you can also do paired lactate and glucose levels compared to the blood to help determine if the fluid is a septic abdomen or not. The other thing you can do is diagnostic peritoneal lavage if you suspect fluid in there that you can't get. It's important for the emergency veterinarian to get good at cytology and to be able to recognize, I think the most important thing to recognize is bacteria in white blood cells and neutrophils. So these little dark blue rods, extracellularly and intracellularly, allow you to diagnose the life-threatening problem of septic abdomen, for instance. And then lastly, some people may have the ability to do colloid osmotic pressure in their practice. This measures the colloid osmotic pressure in the whole blood. Normal is 18 to 20 millimeters of mercury. Albumin is the main source of colloid pressure in the animal. And it's useful to monitor the response to artificial colloid use because there's no other way to realize that you're improving your colloid pressure without measuring it. These machines are very finicky and need membrane changes a lot and can be just really cumbersome. So I don't tend to recommend them unless you're in a practice that does a lot of colloid use. So in conclusion, point-of-care testing is essential to aid in quick diagnosis of life-threatening diseases. The limitations should be recognized, and questionable results should be verified before believing them. Regular quality control and understanding troubleshooting of your machines is imperative. And continued monitoring and assessment of dynamic patients, such as repeating a lot of these tests, is necessary to be proactive in the treatment of critical patients. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions, or I can take them up here. I know that some of it is very, very basic information, but I just think it's so amazing how many things you can rule out with just those simple tests, that you can get most of that information within 10 minutes and have maybe 20 minutes and have an owner be able to make an informed decision about their pet in that time period. Are there any questions? Great. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.